Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home? Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your gray turn blue, gray turn blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care, and I won't let go, even oceans away, you're with me day by day. Memories of you keep flashing through my mind. The very thoughts of you make my time. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope.
Welcome to another episode of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, on this 31st day of January 2010. We have a special episode today, and this is in honor and tribute of the people of Haiti, the strong African struggle that has been going on in Haiti ever since Africans were stolen from their homeland of the native motherland known as Alkabaland, or otherwise known as Africa, and brought to the island of Hispaniola, and specifically in Haiti, what we call Haiti now. So today we're going to be running down the history, the strong history for liberation that the Haitian people have been involved in since they were brought I forcibly brought to Hispaniola. We're going to be talking about that, and we're going to be paying real tribute to Haiti, not like the corporate media does. The corporate media doesn't put things in context, because what really gets me angry and really gets a lot of folks who know the history angry is when you watch the corporate media. There's never a context in which they place Haiti in, and so the average viewer that has been educated in America in these horrendous U.S. public educational systems, even on the collegiate level, people have been so dumbed down and so encapsulated in this this box that is devoid of any critical thought, where people should be asking how did people in Haiti become the most impoverished in the Western Hemisphere? How did that come to be? Most people don't ask that question, and the mainstream media facilitates an environment, an atmosphere where it's this disgusting paternalistic white supremacist, pity, all those poor Haitians, look, they just can't govern themselves, and that's far from the truth. So we're going to be delving into how Haiti became so impoverished, the external factors that have continually been attacking Haiti and its people for centuries now, and we're gonna get into that. I'll be joined briefly by a comrade of mine by the name of Peter Fowler, who will be calling in from Arizona. He's an activist and has been an activist much of his life. He's also a man of the cloth, and much in the same vein of the late great Martin Luther King. Has used his opportunity in the pulpit to speak truth to so-called power, to speak truth to the so-called powers that be, and has used that as an opportunity to mentally liberate and emancipate those who step into his church and who are within his congregation. So he'll be joining us soon. I want to start off with a headline. We're going to go through a couple headlines. And these headlines have been provided to us once again by Black Agenda Report, and I have to say, BlackAgendaReport.com is by far one of the best places where you can get critical analysis of stories that are not just going on within the artificial borders known as the United States of America, but outside those borders. Glenn Ford, Bruce Dixon, Margaret Kimberly, and so many others continually, work hard to place things within their proper context. And Executive Director Glenn Ford, or Executive Editor Glenn Ford, has continually, provided us with some great headlines. So I'm going to let Glenn lead the way. We're going to have a couple headlines, and the last two headlines actually are going to serve as an entree into a dialogue around Haiti and what we can do, because I think it's important for us to understand that as many of us are giving our time, our monetary resources, our supplies, and they're very much needed in Haiti. And, unfortunately, because the U.S. has militarized Haiti right now, a lot of those supplies are bottlenecked up, in the on the tarmac at Haiti's airport. But, as those supplies hopefully make their way to the people on the ground, and Haiti begins to rebuild itself to the limited infrastructure that it had before the earthquake that hit January 12th, it's vastly important. If we want to see Haiti really, really rebuild itself, all right, where they have first responders, where Haiti can play, the nation of Haiti and the people of Haiti can play a major role in helping other Haitians when, natural disasters strike, it's vastly important for us as residents and citizens within the United States of America, it's vastly important for us to understand the forces that be, that come out of Washington, that have created foreign policies that are tremendously destructive and have been tremendously destructive and have also prevented the Haitians from building that infrastructure. All right, these people did not bring this upon themselves. These are external factors that have come out of Washington, that have come out of France, that have come out of Canada, that have played a tremendous role in preventing Haitians from creating, you know, a bountiful society. Because, you know, Haiti is ripe with natural resources, but the people in Haiti are the very, very, very last to benefit from those natural resources. We're gonna get into a lot of this stuff. It's not even something we can even cover in the 90-minute program that we have today, but we're gonna do our best, and we invite anyone who's listening right now to tune in, to call if you will. The number is 347-945-5191. The number is 347-945-5191. I'm gonna play this clip, and then on the other side, we'll be joined by Peter Fowler, and we'll get into the last two clips, which will really propel us and serve as a point of departure into our dialogue around Haiti.
The U.S. Supreme Court has given its approval to what was already an accomplished fact: corporate ownership of the governmental apparatus of the American state. In affirming that corporations have the right to buy as much influence as they can pay for with campaign contributions, the High Court has swept away the last remaining facade of America's Disney World democracy. The U.S. political system is revealed as nothing more than a theme park that offers the public fake election thrills that simulate one man, one vote. The barbaric principle underlying the decision was established 124 years ago when another Supreme Court ruled that corporations had the constitutional rights of persons. Like the recent ruling, the 1886 Supreme Court decision essentially ratified the emerging reality of the day. The corporations were already running the economy and government of the United States as if they owned it. It is said that more than half the U.S. senators own stock in the railroads, stock that had been given to them by the railroad corporations as gifts in return for millions of acres in federal lands. It was the age of the rise of the great robber barons who invented the modern corporation and demanded that their paper avatars be treated as full-fledged citizens of the republic. Dutifully, the Supreme Court complied, providing constitutional justification for already existing corporate rule. The current Supreme Court is simply expanding on the 1886 principle of corporate personhood to fit modern, much more expensive circumstances. The supremacy of corporate power in U.S. elections is a fait accompli, a manifest, self-evident fact. Only corporate persons, or actual human beings associated with corporations, could spend a total of $5.3 billion on the elections of 2008. Barack Obama himself received $650 million, the vast bulk of it from the corporate class, who gave more money to Democrats than to Republicans. The Democrats are complaining that the Supreme Court ruling will further advantage the Republicans. But the more profound effect will be to complete the corporatization of the Democratic Party, whose leadership is already at least as closely allied with Wall Street as the GOP. Remember, it was candidate Barack Obama who saved George Bush's bank bailout bill in 2008 and put Wall Street operatives at the helm of his new administration's economic policy. Wall Street is to the Democrats what big oil is to the Republicans, their sugar daddies. In response to the Supreme Court's damnable decision, more than 40,000 people have joined in support of a move to amend the U.S. Constitution, to once and forever proclaim that corporations are not people, only people are people, with the civil and political rights of human beings. Such a constitutional amendment is necessary to reverse not only the latest travesty from the Supreme Court, but the original sin of 1886, when corporations were recognized as persons. those rulings created a legal construct in which the American people have no rights that a corporation is bound to respect. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And, yeah, that was a very important ruling that, you know, if you thought things were worse right now, you know, that this country has been controlled for a long time by two large, you know, corporate political parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. Very little separates either of them. And, you know, if there's one wish I can have before I make my transition to my elders, you know, hopefully in many, many decades from now, it's that Black people within this country will begin to divorce themselves, willingly divorce themselves from the Democratic Party, not go to the Republican Party, but, you know, look at other alternatives such as the Green Party, looking at this new movement that's building up, the Black is Black, the Black is Back Coalition, or even progressive independence. But, you know, if we thought it was bad before, it's going to get a whole lot worse if this thing isn't changed, because, you know, if you thought corporations were buying candidates before, this really puts a whole new perspective on things and a whole new spin on things. And it's, you know, and that's one of the consequences of living in a hyper uber capitalist society such as the United States of America, which basically the U.S. is kind of like the capital of the capitalistic world. So, anyways, I think we're joined by Peter Fowler. Peter, are you on the line?
Yes, Solomon, right here.
How you doing, Peter? Can you you know, you've been on the show before, but can just for those listeners who haven't who may have not heard the other show that we did on Christianity and the African origins of Christianity, can you introduce yourself to the listeners and after that we'll hit the ground running.
Absolutely. First of all, pleasure to be with you again, Solomon. Peter Fowler, currently in Glendale, Arizona, and I have my present project is co-developing the Academy of Critical Thinking. I also have a background in ministry as a American Baptist minister, and served a number of different congregations in different capacities, and have evolved from that to what I like to call a scholar practitioner. And so one of my endeavors currently with Academy Critical Thinking and some other ventures is to critique the church and the role of Christianity in America, and also have worked as an activist and in social work in a couple of different cities. So let me just say one thing about the previous show that we did on Christmas Day. I made mention of the wretched of the earth, and I misspoke. I attributed that to Paulo Freire, when in fact that phrase was coined by Frantz Fanon. So I just wanted to make that correction before we get started, Solomon. But again, good to be with you, and I think it's crucial that we think critically and address critically the situation in Haiti today.
Definitely, and I want to ask you now, and then also at the end of the show, what's your email address for listeners, just in case they want to get in contact with you after the show and to find out more information about the Academy of Critical Thinking or some of the other work you do? If you could just kind of give your email address.
Yeah, the best way to reach me is peter.fowler@yahoo.com. That's peter.fowler@yahoo.com. And you can also reach me at peter.fowler@theactinc.org.
Okay, and Pete, I was going to ask you just what is your I don't know if you heard the previous news bit that I just provided from Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report.
Yes, I did.
What are your your 2 cents, you know, to weigh in on the recent Supreme Court ruling that basically opened the floodgates for corporations to spend as much money on any political party or any political individual, political figure you know, hence their fourth. What's your opinion on that?
Well, it's a devastating decision. It's one of the great travesties of jurisprudence in this country. And I think when we look at decisions like the recent Citizens United versus the FEC that came down just a week or so ago, we look at Bush versus Gore in 2000, we can see very clearly that the so-called Supreme Court of the United States is a prop, is a tool of the powers that be, of the corporations, and you know, by putting their candidate in office in 2000 in a ruling that they clearly stated themselves in their written ruling, that ruling, Bush v. Gore of 2000, was not to be used as a precedent in any subsequent cases. So they knew on its face that it was fraudulent. But they used it to install Bush in the White House as their man. What this decision does, the Citizens United versus FEC, what that does is it extends the control of corporations to essentially buy political office outright. And, you know, we know that the corporations have had a tremendous influence in the machinations of Washington, whether it's the Senate, the House, and, of course, the White House as well. What this does is it takes any semblance of democracy and removes it from the equation. You know, this is not about one people or one person, one vote. This is about the most money gets the most votes. And what's significant about this for the left, for those of us who are on the left politically, and especially for those people who have supported Obama throughout this process and throughout the historic nomination and election last year of America's first black president, you know, we've been evaluating and assessing Obama recently ad nauseum. And rightly so, because what he has done is he has failed the supporters who swept him into office. And so we've seen the election in Massachusetts with Scott Brown replacing Ted Kennedy, a historic election that, you know, a couple years ago no one could ever have foreseen something like that happening in Kennedy's district. And so we're seeing that, and it's being analyzed in as a backlash against the Obama administration. So people are angry, people are upset, people are disappointed and disillusioned with Obama, with the Democrats as a party, because of their failure to respond to the people and the issues for which they were elected, namely improving the economy, improving the situation for working people in this country, ending the wars, the imperialistic wars in the Middle East, and other issues. Obviously, the administration has done nothing to address those issues, but has further extended the policies of the Bush administration. So people are angry about that, and rightly so. And so we're hearing talk about the election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts as possibly a precursor or forerunner to the Democrats being booted out of control in the Senate and in the House in the midterm elections, and then the possibility of Obama being ousted from the White House in 2012. But the ruling, Solomon, of the Supreme Court has made the anger of the population a moot point, because it's not going to matter how many citizens are mobilized to vote for one candidate or another, because what we're seeing is Obama is serving the interests of the corporations who paid for his election. One of the things that Glenn Ford mentioned in the opening piece was the amount of money that was in Obama's so-called war chest going into the election. And that's why he got elected. That's the bottom line, is he had the money to get elected. We're going to see the corporations whom he is serving continue to support Obama, and that's what's going to be important. It has nothing to do with whether Obama and his administration is responsive to the American people, to the people of this country, whether or not he gains re-election in 2012. What this decision does is it basically puts the election of our highest officials in this country, including the president, into the hands of the corporations. It's a bald-faced power grab by the corporations and a naked, thumbing of the nose of the Supreme Court at the American citizenry.
Right.
It's a scandal. It's a scandal of historic proportions, Solomon.
Exactly, and it affirms, what I've been saying for a long time is that we don't live in a democracy. We live in a plutocracy where those who have the most money, they're the ones that get their message out. You know, they buy the multi-million-dollar ads in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, LA Times, and so forth. They're the ones that, are able to buy half-hour ads, as Obama did, a week before his election. And unfortunately, United States, is full of a populace that, because of this, are very, very, politically uninformed. If I want to, euphemize things, I can use a lot of the descriptors to be a little bit more straightforward. But the U.S. the U.S. Populace, by and large, the masses of people are very much politically uninformed, and so you can flash. It's almost like just feeding the sheep. And you being the shepherd. If you're the shepherd and you have this almost unlimited amount of monetary resources, you can continue to flash, your ads in print, in print media, and audio media over the radio, visual media, on the television. And the more and more you flash, your face, your campaign, your ads, people are gonna gravitate towards, one of those candidates without actually taking the time to actually research how this person has voted and such, because there came a time where, I was just, was just getting in these kind of, impasses with Obamaites, leading into the election, and they're saying, oh, well, he's just gonna, he's just saying these things because, and once he gets into office, such and such, you can't base everything on what he's saying. I'm not basing the reason I'm not voting for him, and I proudly voted for Cynthia McKinney and the Green Party candidate. I said, I'm not voting for him solely based on what he's saying. I said, look at his voting record. Look at how he voted on FISA. How do you feel, and I would ask them first. I said, how do you feel about the government, having illegal wiretaps or making wiretaps, constitutionally legal, to tap into your cell phone or what have you based on suspicion, it harks, the remembrance of COINTELPRO. And so how do you feel? And they're like, that's not right. I said, well, did you know your candidate voted for FISA?
Yeah, that's probably one of the biggest points of misinformation amongst the electorate, the populace today, is the misconception that the United States is a democracy. It never has been, and it certainly isn't now. And if there was any illusion of democracy remaining, this recent court decision should eliminate that altogether. And we've got to not only look at Obama as a senator and some of his voting records, like you mentioned, which is crucial, and people didn't do that. But even going back to immediately after his election, even before the inauguration, the team that he put together to be his brain trust, if you will, his economic team, the highest appointments to some of the most important and influential positions and posts in his administration went to basically the barons of Wall Street. And there's no mistaking his intentions once he made those appointments. And how can we expect anything else than the decisions and policies that have come from his administration based on who he has appointed to those crucial positions? And I would commend your listeners to Matt Taibbi's piece in Rolling Stone from December of 2009, and he goes into that in detail, and it is literally jaw-dropping to read through that and look at the appointments that Obama made to the most important positions, particularly economic positions. And not only that, but you look at some of the carryover from the Bush administration, you know, the fact that he kept Gates at the Department of War, better known as the Department of Defense, it was another indication of where the trajectory of his foreign policy was going to go. So the fact of the matter is, the American people got what they asked for, you know,
exactly.
And there shouldn't be any surprise. The anger absolutely is warranted. People ought to be angry. People ought to be pissed off. But surprised? No, not at all.
Exactly, exactly. And so, like, within that, since we're talking about corporations, and it, you know, it's an easy, once you learn about how corporations, you know, and then basically it's, you know, you could say we're living in a fascist society, which is the merger of the state and the corporation. You can't remove military from the corporate element in America, because, you know, we also have a military-industrial complex, and based on that, I want to use that as a segue into this 2-minute briefing by Glenn Ford, and then afterwards this and this is on Haiti. You know, it's it talks about the U.S. Impact, negative impact on Haiti, and after that, let's get into the nuts and bolts about Haiti and what the corporate media has not you know, involuntarily but voluntarily omitted from their newscast.
The American commandeering of the airport at Port-au-Prince and de facto seizure of sovereignty over Haiti looked exactly like an invasion and occupation, except that Haiti had already been invaded in 2004 by the U.S., which then turned over occupational duties to its servants in the United Nations. To speak of a U.S. invasion of Haiti is getting a little bit redundant. The Americans never left, and they and their flunkies walk all over Haiti like an old rug. Clearly, however, the U.S. was not on an earthquake rescue mission. U.S. naval units sailed into Haitian waters without bothering to load up with food, water, and medicine at the nearby U.S. base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. What kind of relief mission was this, in which the rescuer comes empty-handed? Thousands of paratroopers were flown in from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and then sat at the Port-au-Prince airport for several days, claiming not to have transportation into town. They could have walked. The city is just beyond the airport fence, and downtown and the port are only a couple of miles away. A BBC reporter noted that several days after the paratroopers landed, they sent small relief missions to outlying areas. Meanwhile, literally right down the street was the vast shantytown of Cité Soleil. But the Americans didn't go there. The United States military, except for its special operations units, is the heaviest fighting force in the world. That means the Americans require more logistical support, more pounds of equipment, more fresh food, more support personnel for every grunt with a gun than any military on the planet. When the U.S. decided to airlift thousands of troops into Port-au-Prince, commanders knew the logistical needs of that force alone would overwhelm the airport's capacity, leaving little room for actual relief supplies. The Americans knew that they would be creating a bottleneck that would become an impediment to relief efforts by the rest of the world. But they hogged the air and runways anyway. What was the purpose? The explanation is quite simple. For the Americans, the operation was not primarily a rescue mission. Often, they carried only supplies for themselves. I don't buy into the speculation that the Americans were attempting to worsen the Haitian situation through deliberate delays in order to justify taking over the country. It was clear from the first day that the earthquake was a visitation from hell that would create more than enough drama than the U.S. would ever need. And besides, the Americans and their minions were already in charge of Haiti. But the Americans' actions make perfect sense when understood as an air and naval exercise to test the capabilities of the U.S. Southern Command to move its own men and machines from one place to another quickly. The Southern Command's Fourth Fleet was just taken out of mothballs last year and has been staging exercises in the Caribbean to threaten Venezuela. The U.S. has just opened 7 new bases in Colombia and would be anxious to test its ability to support them with quick infusions of large units of troops and equipment. The Haitian earthquake was a good excuse, but the mission was not about them. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So Peter, for our listeners that know, this is, I think it'd be remiss if we didn't do a brief, and I emphasize the word brief, you know, because the history of the Haitian people is much longer than you know, any 90-minute show can give its just due. But to put things into context, we have a nation that claimed independence. It was the first nation of formerly enslaved Africans to claim, you know, independence as a nation. We know that there were slave revolts in different parts of the world, such as Brazil, where slaves, you know, created a community for themselves, you know, called Palmares, and within Brazil. And we know that in Jamaica there were the Maroons, and in Guyana the Cimarroons, and so forth. And that struggle for freedom and that resistance has always run strong through enslaved Africans. But the Haitians were able to form an entirely independent nation, you know, when they overthrew the French, and you know, first was the first, you know, shiftless Europeans that brought African slaves over there, and you know, after they killed off of the indigenous Arawak and Taino, you know, were the Spaniards, and once the Spaniards relinquished control of Hispaniola, which, you know, makes up Haiti and the Dominican Republic, then the French, you know, came in, and it was the likes of the father of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and the likes of Toussaint Louverture and so many others that fought valiantly, you know, during 1791 to 1804, January 1st, 1804, which is when they got their independence. And afterwards, they were never able to really have an opportunity to really build themselves as a free and independent nation the same way shiftless Europeans took control of Turtle Island, otherwise known as North America, United States of America, when they came here under different circumstances and basically brought disease and killed off millions, tens of millions of indigenous from stolen coast to stolen coast. But, you know, but they actually were able to, based on stealing Africans and using slavery to build up their economic system in the United States of America, the Haitians were not able to build a nation, in any shape, form, or fashion. Why? Because France, France used its military might subsequent to 1804 to impose reparations, and also the U.S., you know, I might add, placed sanctions, placed brutal economic sanctions on Haiti. Why? Because of white supremacy and just outright racism, because, you know, Haiti stood as a beacon for all Africans throughout the world that, wow, you know what I'm saying, this is an inspiration, and those Europeans, whether they may be in the U.S. or anywhere in Europe, they looked at Haiti, they were very, very angry very, very angry about that. And so, you know, the U.S. placed harsh economic sanctions. The France used its military might after being defeated. They used their military might to impose reparations to the tune of between 150 to 160 million francs, which, you know, by today's standards, is somewhere in the total well over $20 billion at least. And it took the Haitians until 1947 to pay that off completely, to, you know, where they were paying 80% of their annual budget. They were paying 80% of their annual budget to those reparations, as well as some of that money was actually going to U.S. banks as well. And so that's something that would cripple any nation. I mean, we're you know, fretting about this recession that we're in right now. I mean, if you imagine if the 80% of the U.S. budget went to paying just one thing that was not going to towards any kind of infrastructure, whether it may be social or physical infrastructure in the U.S., it would cripple any nation. And then the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934 militarily. There was resistance there, and in one battle alone, the U.S. Marines killed 2,000 Haitians, and so countless thousands of Haitians were killed were slaughtered during the U.S. military occupation. And so I say that Peter, that, and I'll stop there, you know, briefly, I'll let you come in. But the important thing is that we haven't even touched upon the modern day, the contemporary plunder that has gone on, and we'll get to that. We'll get to the fat, you know what I'm saying, hillbilly Bill Clinton. We'll get into the nitwit, but George W. Bush, you know, the buffoon, and we'll get into his scoundrel, evil father, H.W. Bush. We'll get into the roles that they played, and we can even touch on the you know, one of the devils himself, Ronald Reagan. We can touch on the role he played in supporting, you know, Papa Doc and Baby Doc simply because they were anti-communist, anti-socialist. But I'll let you, I digress, I'll let you, you know, touch on some of the things that you think that listeners should know in terms of putting things into a deeper context.
Yeah, absolutely. We do need to look at a deeper historical context as well as a broader ideological context to understand what's going on in Haiti. You know, what has tipped this off was an earthquake, an isolated incident, the shifting of massive tectonic plates, you know, underneath the surface of the earth. But the catastrophe, Solomon, was a catastrophe of capitalism fueled by racism that started well before this earthquake. I'm talking about 500 years before this earthquake. Now, you know, some people are talking about what we need 500 years ago. Christopher Columbus, one of the greatest myths of Americanism, is the discovery of America by the vaunted and heroic Christopher Columbus. First of all, Christopher Columbus was lost. He was looking for a route to the Orient, the so-called Orient. But he ran into a little island in what's now the Caribbean, and it was populated by a gentle and loving and warm people, commonly known as the Arawaks. They were systematically annihilated from the island Columbus called Hispaniola in honor of the Spanish crown whom he was sailing for. So that's when the catastrophe began, was in 1492, when Europeans reached the shore of that tiny island that they renamed Hispaniola and began a systematic annihilation of the indigenous population. Find an Arawak on this planet today. You can't, because there aren't any more. They annihilated every last one of them. And so we go back to the incursion of Western, and this is pre-capitalism in terms of the forms that we know it today, but still Western capital seeking riches and devastating the island of Hispaniola. And then we see the development of the capitalist structures that needed labor, and that's where the slave trade jumped off in Hispaniola. Both the French side, which is now Haiti, and the former Spanish side, the Dominican Republic. So if we go back that far, Solomon, we can begin to see what happened. And then if we continue along that axis to see the role of the United States, and it's ironic, it's tragically ironic to see that the United States is throwing off the yokes of colonialism with the Revolutionary War in the 1770s, 1780s, and when the former slaves in their neighbor to the south use the documents of the French Revolution that also inspired the American Revolution, and also using the documents and the language of the American Declaration of Independence, claiming some of that tradition as their own, the fledgling United States not only did not refuse to help the Haitian people, but essentially sided with Britain and France in that embargo, economic embargo, which was the beginning of the decline for a economically viable and independent nation. So the United States took a stance immediately to not assist the Haitian people, but to continue to keep them in chains and enslaved economically, even though they were free politically from France. You know, and then we fast forward to 1862, and it was for political reasons only that in 1862 the United States finally recognizes Haiti as an independent and sovereign nation. And then we fast forward, like you mentioned, to 1915 when the United States Marines, invaded and occupied Haiti, and you know, ostensibly that was because there was a German presence in Haiti and the United States. We were taught that, you know, this was a benevolent intervention on behalf of the United States to prevent a German takeover of Haiti. When in fact, we look back just a few years to 1910, 1911, when the U.S. banking industry started to invest heavily, and the U.S. State Department was involved, and so there were high economic stakes for American capital, and that's why the President of the United States intervened on behalf of American capital, on behalf of American corporations, the banking industry in particular, to send in the Marines in order to stabilize Haiti so that the United States could continue to reap the windfall of economic profits from basically exploiting the Haitian economy. And then, you know, propping up Papa Doc and Baby Doc and all the way up to today. So we have to look along the axis of historical continuity, you know.
Right.
And the other two axes, Solomon, I think we need to look at least with a trifocal perspective on the bigger picture. And the first of that is that historical continuity. The other two are the geopolitical strategy behind the current occupation. And then probably the most important is the economic hegemony of American capital, Western capital.
Right.
You know, and one of the things Glenn Ford mentioned in that previous piece was the South American command unit of the military. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that we look at the geopolitical strategy of an occupied Haiti in its relation to Cuba, as well as the South American continent. So,
exactly.
You know, a presence in Haiti is a strategic presence militarily for the United States to continue to exploit Cuba, and it's also a point of operation for the United States to, in the future, make some offensives in the South American continent.
Right, exactly, and I'm glad you brought up, especially when the U.S. finally recognized Haiti as an independent nation, and you know, for those you know who might be quick to jump the gun and say, oh wow, you know, they're doing something good, that was for their own self-interest. You know,
absolutely.
Lincoln you know, Lincoln gets way too many props in terms of the role he played. I mean, he signed the Emancipation Proclamation. He did not think very highly of black people whatsoever. He thought they were much lower on the totem pole than their white counterparts. And many papers have been written, you know, about, you know, when he, you know, recognized Haiti as an independent nation was largely based on the fact that hoping that this might serve as an impetus for Africans that in the U.S. to repatriate into countries like Haiti. We know about the history of Liberia, and so it wasn't the benevolent altruistic U.S. you know, through the office of the presidency, you know doing the right thing. They definitely had their own best interests, you know, in recognizing Haiti. But then you mentioned, you know, the geopolitical structure going on right now and the strategic positioning that Haiti is, you know, to Cuba as well as to Venezuela. We see more and more Latin American countries starting to lean left and go to towards socialist governments. We see that Nicaragua going back to Daniel Ortega. We've seen Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and he's you know, since he's been in power, has been a thorn in America's side. He's not afraid of America's power whatsoever when asked to give, or not even asked to give his comments on America's role. I mean, he's given his very, very accurate comments in terms of that it looks like America is the U.S. is occupying, militarily occupying Haiti. And Reagan, you know, Reagan knew the position of Haiti. He knew that at that time it was well known that Castro in Cuba, socialist government there, communist nation, and Papa Doc was anti-communist. And so even though he was an evil dictator, as well as his son, and, you know, they had a, you know, death squad known as Tonton Macoutes, you know, that killed thousands and thousands of Haitians. You know what I'm saying? Reagan didn't give a damn about those thousands upon thousands of black Haitians that were getting maimed and massacred and slaughtered. Did not give a damn. He cared more about supporting an evil dictator, two of them, you know what I'm saying, based on his own country's, you know, so-called, you know, political interests. And that's the interesting thing. And so you know, and in the process, Papa Doc siphoned out tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, extorted tens of millions of dollars from his people. And so when people say, oh, you know, these poor, they're ungovernable. No, you know, the U.S. has supported and propped up dictators who extorted from their own country, and the U.S. continued to support them militarily and diplomatically. And so let's bring it full circle. So we look at the 90s when the Haitians elected in a popular former priest by the name of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, elected him, you know, his party was Lavalas, elected him. He was wildly, you know, popular, and he was elected and had a range of social reforms that he had planned. And one of those social reforms, you know, he wanted to raise the minimum wage, all these different things. And so what did Bush 1 do, George H.W. Bush do? What he did was he orchestrated a coup, had him removed from office, and then, you know, the hillbilly Bill Clinton gets into office, and Bill Clinton in his campaign says that he's willing to grant asylum to many, many Haitians. And so he says that during his campaign. He gets into office, goes back on his words. You have folks like Randall Robinson going on hunger strikes to get Clinton to reverse, you know, to go back on his, you know, to go back to his original word. And Clinton says, you know, I'll bring Aristide back. Aristide, I'll bring you back under one condition. under, well, several conditions. And one of those conditions was that you must allow the U.S. to flood your country with cheap U.S. subsidized rice, flour, you know what I'm saying, those types of things. And where you, so you had, you know, Haitian farmers, Haitian rice farmers that were unable to support themselves, unable to stay in business because they were forced out of business because of cheap U.S. rice, where you saw the tariffs go from something like 47% down to like 2 or 3%.
So is anyone asking that question?
No one is asking a question
why Haiti is the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. We've heard that a lot in the media since the earthquake about, you know, the poor Haitians, it's the, you know, an impoverished country. Why is it such a poor country? Why this country, once so rich in natural resources, we are so impoverished? And it's those kind of intentional actions of the United States and Western capital that has worked to impoverish the Haitian people. And so, you know, we look at the history that you just detailed in terms of the support of treacherous regimes in Haiti, the Duvaliers, and the undermining of democratically elected presidents in Haiti, and the role of the United States presidency to continue to keep Haiti impoverished. And I have to ask this question then, knowing that history and knowing the intentions of the United States and their role in the strangling of Haiti, what has changed? What has changed that now we're expected to believe that this militarized relief effort is supposed to be this benevolent action on behalf of the United States to rush to the aid of the Haitian people? What has changed that we are expected to believe that now the United States acts out of the goodness of its heart to help the Haitian people, when for the last, since 1804, since Haiti became a nation, the United States has been nothing but a weight around its neck? What has changed, Solomon? Has anything changed? Nothing has changed, and so how can I expect people to believe that the United States is acting in the best interest of the Haitian people, given the history of the relationship between the United States and Haiti? It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up.
No, not at all. And that's, I mean, that's a problem with the society we live in right now, you know, whether it's in Arizona or whether it's in Washington, D.C. or Maryland or, you know what I'm saying, or Texas, is that Americans by and large live, I mean, they live in this, this alternate universe where they can turn on the TV and see destruction, destruction caused by a calamity of nature, and not even you know, be astute enough to say, well, why do they get to be so? How do they get to be so damn poor that they don't even have first responders? That they don't even have infrastructure on the outskirts of where the earthquake hit to get those folks into shelter and to provide them with food? What, why? You know what I'm saying? So, and that's one of the most frustrating and infuriating things is that Americans live in this thing. So they feel like, I don't want to minimize people, you know, texting this, that, and the other, you know, but, you know, also that's something that we need to think about is that a lot of the aid that is given to places like the Red Cross and other so-called aid agencies don't make their way to the folks. We saw how that was handled during Katrina. But, you know, Americans live in this box where these critical questions, as you said before, these critical questions are not even asked. They're not even covered in any shape, form, or fashion in civics classes or social studies classes from middle school to high school. And for the most part, most colleges don't function to produce radical or revolutionary or actually good, or just basically good global citizens. They are to produce the next elitist class that will go into America, you know what I'm saying, regardless of the fact that they may or may not have come from impoverished communities themselves, But when they finish their 4 or 5 years and they matriculate and they graduate, they now have this new mentality based on the way that they've been educated at the university level, that they are somehow the privileged class, and they have pulled themselves up by the bootstraps, and all those who have not had the opportunity, or all those who are not in college right now, it's simply because they didn't work hard enough. They didn't work hard enough. Now we know that's a crock of crap. That's not the case. America is not a society that wishes to educate the masses of its children on the collegiate level, because that would move more and more towards a classless society. But looking at geopolitical issues, it is absolutely disgusting that more people didn't ask themselves that key question that you pose, Peter. And you know, the land that Haiti is on is made up primarily of limestone. Limestone is the base. It is one of the base ingredients that goes into creating concrete. And there, at one time, Haiti was exporting a lot of concrete to other countries and getting revenue. Not a ton of revenue, but was getting revenue from that. And the U.S., you know what I'm saying, went ahead and forced them to privatize their cement industry. They privatized it, and then it went out of business. Nothing was done to resuscitate it. The U.S., through Clinton's policy, through the use of the IMF and World Bank, and the only thing international or worldly about the IMF and World Bank is the name. It is, they are controlled by the U.S., you know what I'm saying? Were created by, you know what I'm saying, on U.S. territory, New Hampshire, Bretton Woods, that's a whole other story, and they control those institutions in major, major ways. And so, yes, they flooded the damn country with rice. And for somebody to sit there and say, oh, why did they let them do that? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You know what I'm saying? Why did they let them do that? They had no other freaking choice, you know? And so to bring things to 2004, so Aristide was brought back into power, you know, with those huge strings attached, you know, by rule of Bill Clinton and his empire. And then 2004, George W. Bush, the dimwit idiot, only in America you have somebody, you know, that has the intelligence of a baboon, elected as president not once but twice.
Let's be clear, Solomon. He was not elected.
Yeah. It still blows my mind that you even had, you know, 40 million people actually. Yeah, he stole it in 2004. He stole it in 2000. But it even blows my mind that you actually had tens of millions of people still vote for this nitwit in 2004 after the fact that it was put out there that there was a smoking gun, that this, you know, that this war in Iraq was based on lies. And it just blows my mind that you would still have that many people even make it competitive. And yes, the Bush administration through Kenneth Blackwell and other folks, you know, from the state they used to reside in, stole election. And, you know what I'm saying, by using Ohio as his base and disfranchising voters in the Columbus area of Ohio. It, you know, yes, it was stolen again. But he removed Aristide in 2004. He removed him, took him to the Central African Republic, you know, and then he was brought by members of the Congressional Black Caucus. They helped, you know, bring him to South Africa, where he is now. But and what's funny, and I'll stop here and I'll let you go, is that his former political party, Lavalas Fanmi, is by far the most popular political party on the ground in Haiti. But here's the thing, Peter, as you know, they are banned. They are banned from elections. They just they are banned from participating in elections. And so you have this guy, René Préval, who is a U.S. puppet, you know what I'm saying, basically giving, you know what I'm saying, basically assured that he's going to win, you know, subsequent elections. How the hell is that possible that they are banned, you know what I'm saying? And it is direct influence from the U.S. Let some other country come in and tell the U.S. the Republicans or the Democrats are banned from any given election. That, you know what I'm saying? It would not happen, Peter.
Absolutely. You know, and that exposes the anti-democratic nature of the United States government, not only with regard to its own citizenry, you and me, but particularly with regard to other countries and the United States government's interference in the politics of other countries going back two centuries. And, you know, we talk about the soft-mindedness of the general public and how easily misled and misinformed Americans generally can be. Yet and still, what do we hear on the corporate media? What's one of the, at this point, most infamous remarks coming from Pat Robertson about why Haiti is in the condition that she is? It had nothing to do with the realities of politics and economics and racism, but it had to do with what? A deal with the devil. Now, you know, if it weren't so tragic, we could just laugh that off as the ramblings of a nearly senile old fool. But the fact of the matter is that there are all too many Americans who will take that kind of explanation seriously. And the role of the Christian church is something that ought to be looked at critically in the history of Haiti, going all the way back to 1492 and then making a connection to 2010. Because what Pat Robertson said is an oversimplified and idiotic and superstitious a distraction from reality. Obviously, we know that. I think anybody with half a brain recognizes that what Pat Robertson said, and pretty much anything Pat Robertson says, is a lot of nonsense. But if we go back to 1492 and the role of the Christian Church in Haiti, what's now Haiti, it was the Christian Church who Columbus spoke on behalf of. When he got off and stood on the shores, he read an edict that was an attempt to proselytize the people of that island. And you can read about this in some of the works by Howard Zinn, who just passed away this past week. But a great historian. And he talks about the role of the church and the role of so-called Christians in the rape of the island and the destruction of the island. And so we see that and how the church condoned the genocide in Hispaniola in 1492 and the following decades, in which all the Arawaks were exterminated. And then we fast forward to 2010, and we see a spokesman for the American church talking about a deal with the devil. And instead of talking about the deals, the literal deals, the pacts with capital, let's talk about pacts and contracts with capital and with the American government and other institutional economic industries of the West. I mean, I'm talking about the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization and NAFTA. Those are the pacts and the contracts that we need to be examining critically. And so this is a case study for us. It's an opportunity for us to correct the soft-mindedness and the misinformation that is so rampant in our society, and for us to challenge the kind of nonsense that's being peddled by the corporate media and is coming out of the mouths of fools like Pat Robertson. That's what that's what this is for us, Solomon. And you're taking advantage of it by going on the air and also sending your students to Haiti and talking to your students about this on a regular basis. We have to challenge the misunderstandings, the misinformation, and the status quo of the intentions of the United States government with regard to Haiti, and all we have to do is look at the facts, you know. And how are we expected to take seriously you know, the government's contentions that it's trying its best to rush aid and relief to impoverished Haitians, when millions upon millions of Americans, American citizens right here in good old U.S. of A., are languishing in poverty, unemployment, squalid living conditions. How are we expected to believe that? How are we expected to believe that the United States government is serious about helping Haitians when the United States government is simultaneously conducting genocidal wars and occupations against other impoverished people on the other side of the planet? I'm talking about Iraq, Afghanistan. One of the first things Obama did when he got into office was start predatory attacks into Pakistan, and now we see on the horizon a conflict with Yemen. How are we supposed to believe that the United States has benevolent intentions in Haiti? How are we supposed to believe that the United States government is doing its best to help the Haitian people when Haiti's Caribbean neighbor, Cuba, has been the target of economic violence for the past 50 years simply because Cuba refuses to be controlled economically by Western capital? How are we supposed to believe that? And then the ultimate example, perhaps, is the unnatural disaster following Hurricane Katrina along the Gulf Coast. What that did was it exposed the indifference of the United States government. It wasn't just George Bush. You know, Kanye West, he certainly was right on point when he said George Bush doesn't like black people. That's pretty clear. But it goes beyond George Bush. It was the entire U.S. government apparatus that was indifferent to its own citizens, especially non-white citizens and poor citizens. And it used that disaster, Hurricane Katrina, to exploit an opportunity to further privatize and corporatize the economy of the Gulf Coast. And we've seen that. It's a fact. It's a fact. And so that's the lens that we need to apply to what's happening in Haiti today, not only the historical lens that we've talked about over these past several minutes, but also the contemporary lens of what the United States government is doing currently abroad as well as domestically. And then we're expected to believe that the United States has benevolent intentions for Haiti. It's strange credibility, and it's simply not believable. And so we need to use this opportunity to highlight those realities. This is a teaching moment. This is a teaching moment for the left, Solomon, for us to use this almost as a case study to take a look at the role of the United States, the intentions of the United States government, the crucial role of capital and capitalism in the geopolitics of the 21st century.
Just let me
finish by saying, you know, of course racism is stamped all over the situation. You know, how else do we understand the United States stance towards Haiti going back to 1804 when it refused to recognize, you know, a country that very similar to itself was throwing off the yokes of colonialism? How else do we understand that? You know, and the parallels to post Katrina New Orleans are clear. And what is ironic about it, and I'll turn it back to you on this note, what is so ironic about it is that the face of American imperialism and racism is now Barack Obama, a black American.
Exactly. And even more sick and sadistic twist of irony is that, you know, you have two presidents that have done irreparable damage to Haiti and its good people. Now overseeing the aid relief efforts of the U.S. and that's beyond
irony, and that's pure effrontery. It's an insult to the Haitian people. It's a slap in the face.
Exactly,
it really is.
And Pete, you brought up military, and I want to get your comments on this. I'm going to play this really quickly. I want to get your comments because you just brought something up that really triggered something that I was thinking about prior to the show, but you reminded me, and I want to get your feedback on this.
It is understandable that many African Americans are making comparisons between the militarized character of the U.S. intervention in Haiti's earthquake disaster and the federal government's largely military response to the Katrina catastrophe in New Orleans 4.5 years ago. it is quite reasonable to conclude that the U.S. government is more concerned about law and order issues than in attending to the immediate needs of desperate disaster victims, especially when the victims are black. History tells us that U.S. governments regard masses of black people first as potential threats to security, and only second as fellow human beings deserving of assistance. Nevertheless, the heavy-handed militarization of U.S. disaster aid to Haiti should be seen in a larger context. As a matter of established American policy, the military has been assigned prime responsibility for U.S. foreign disaster relief worldwide. It's not just Haiti and New Orleans or black people. When the biggest tidal wave in recorded history killed nearly 230,000 people in 14 countries in 2004, a death toll that some fear may be reached in Haiti, the face of U.S. disaster aid was overwhelmingly military, so much so that the government of Indonesia, the epicenter of the undersea earthquake, was initially hesitant to allow the Americans in. The Pakistani government's response was much the same the next year, when 80,000 people died in an earthquake. The American aid mission to Pakistan looked more like an invasion, which was not an irrational fear, as subsequent events have shown. It's not just disaster relief that has been militarized. The U.S. military command in Africa, AFRICOM, has assumed responsibility for much of the day-to-day duties once performed by the State Department and other civilian agencies. More often than not, the uniformed military is the dispenser of a wide range of U.S. foreign aid in Africa as part of a general militarization of U.S. relations with the rest of the planet. This U.S. policy of putting the military in charge of not only disaster relief, but foreign assistance in general, is an outgrowth of the collapse of the Soviet Union nearly two decades ago. As the world's only superpower, the Americans began comparing themselves to ancient Rome. If weaker nations recoil at the prospect of American legions stomping around their country, well, that's too bad. If they want American aid, they'll have to accept the U.S. military presence. The military's dominance in U.S. relations with other nations is also evident in the size of the embassies the U.S. is building around the world. The largest is in Iraq and is designed more like a junior Pentagon than a civilian facility. The sheer size of the embassy the Americans are building in Pakistan is a huge source of public outrage and fear. And the fifth largest U.S. embassy in the world sits in Haiti, one of the planet's most economically unimportant nations. What purpose could it possibly serve other than as a U.S. military and dirty tricks base for the U.S. Southern Command, which now decides what gets in and out of Haiti? For all practical purposes, the U.S. Southern Command is the occupying power in Haiti. What we are observing is imperialism in action, under cover of disaster. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And if this show is piqued your interest, if this is, you know, the first time you're listening, whether you're listening live or on archive, and I know that we have a lot of people listening on live, that are listening live right now, as I see the switchboard, you know, feel free to call in. I see that, you know, we have a lot of listeners right now. You don't have to call in, but if you want to call in, please do. But if this has piqued your interest whatsoever, please, and it should pique your interest, if you want to consider yourself a good global citizen, make sure that, you know, you can start by going to blackagendareport.com and just type it in Haiti. There's a ton of articles on Haiti there that will lead you to other articles, that will lead you to books and those types of things, you know, where you can educate yourself and find out more about the root causes of why the Haitian people have been so impoverished for so long, why they didn't have the infrastructure in place to help their own. And then once you're able to educate yourself, it makes you a much better warrior and you know, the global fight to end, you know, foreign policy and imperialistic wars and neocolonization. And these are the things that we need to, as good citizens, if you want to consider yourself the most patriotic, you know, citizen or American, is not the idiot running around, you know, from healthcare town hall meeting to healthcare town hall meeting, you know, yelling about, you know, that, you know, socialized healthcare is an infringement on their civil liberties or this, that, and the other. The most patriotic American is the one that is willing to put on their sweatpants, put on their rubber gloves, and clean the hell out of their dirty, funky house, which is what America is now. It's a dirty, funky house that needs to be cleaned up of domestic and foreign policies that hurt the most impressionable, the sickest, the poorest, of not just our own nation but throughout the world, you know. And those are things that we need to do. We need to truly have a revolution, in that comprises people from various walks of life, putting their resources and pulling their resources together to pressure the hell out of this government, to get the hell out, you know what I'm saying, and to put in, you know, elected officials and parties that are really for the people and by the people, because change is not going to come from the top up. It's only going to come from the grassroots. It's not going to come from these, you know, corporate folks. It's not going to come from the 1% of this country that controls more wealth than the bottom 90%. It's not going to come from these political parties. Yeah, you have individuals in the Democratic Party that are willing to do the right thing, such as, you know, Dennis Kucinich and even though Bernie Sanders is an independent, you have those kind of folks. But by and large, the Democrats are a corporate party just like the Republican Party, and they've shown that they're more than willing to toe the company line and not go and not serve the best interests of their constituents. They're a bunch of I guess it's, you know, I'm going to try to be, you know, I'm not going to go there, but the word I like to use is very strong, but they're very weak. They're very weak, and they're very fragile, and they're not to be supported. So educate yourself. I've actually extended this show an extra half hour. So instead of ending at 4:30, we're gonna end at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Pete, what do you think of what do you think of that clip in terms of the military and Glenn Ford talking about the military? I remember I spoke to you last night, Peter,
right,
and I told you that a couple of my comrades were on the ground in Hispaniola, and they told me that it really looked like the U.S. government was at war with Haiti, because there are Marines everywhere. There are Marines everywhere, toting guns, flying helicopters up, dropping loaves of bread down, treating the Haitians like they're common dogs. And so the military presence is there. So, you know, any comments, reflections based on the last clip?
Yeah, absolutely. Another poignant piece by Glenn Ford. And I'm also glad that you brought that up about your students we talked about last night in terms of their experience on the ground in Haiti. Just for folks to really hear, even if it's second and third hand, about what's really happening on the ground in Haiti in terms of the military presence there, and how people who have just endured and are still enduring an unbelievably traumatic catastrophe, the kind of thing that most of us would never be able to imagine. Hopefully we'll never have to deal with anything like that. But these traumatized and devastated people, hungry and thirsty people, injured and traumatized people are being given relief at the point of a gun. It's ludicrous, it's tragic, and it's the kind of thing that we need to be outraged about. And it is simply symptomatic of the larger militarization of society, and we see that in the United States. One of the things that the Obama administration is proposing right now is a freeze in spending. Except for, guess what, military spending, what they're calling security. Obama is asking for tens of billions of dollars on top of the hundreds of billions of dollars, what's approaching $1 trillion now in expenditures of our money in the genocide and occupation in Iraq, Afghanistan, and furthering that whole sociocide into Pakistan and Yemen and God knows where else. We hear the saber rattling towards Iran. And obviously the United States has to position itself to maintain its hegemony in the Western Hemisphere. That's why we're seeing things with the construction of the embassy of ridiculous proportions in Haiti, and why we're seeing the increased military presence in Colombia so that it can gain that stronghold. In fact, that's the role that Israel has played for the United States in the Middle East since 1968. You know, why this this relationship between the United States and Israel? It's very clear. It's a geopolitical relationship. Israel is a client state for the United States military to gain a foothold in the Middle East. It's pretty clear. And so what we're seeing, and what Glenn Ford just talked about, is the precipitous escalation of that kind of militarization on a global scale. It is frightening. It is the kind of thing that United States citizens need to be aware of, need to be outraged by, and need to be taken action to do something about it. Because, you know, if nothing else, it is an irresponsible expenditure of taxpayer dollars. You know, you mentioned some of the knuckleheads who were, you know, at the town hall meeting, you know, and decrying Obamacare, the so-called Obamacare, and you know, not wanting don't spend my tax dollars to help other sick people. Well, you know, but nobody questions their tax dollars being spent to militarize the globe and to occupy foreign countries and to buy more and more military hardware. So what we're seeing is a very serious turn towards the militarization of society. And, you know, we're not seeing the kind of military presence in the streets of the United States, but we will see that. And the groundwork has already been laid for that. The groundwork is already there. The political decisions have already been made. And we can be in that kind of a situation virtually overnight by caveat of a president. And so it's the kind of thing that we need to be aware of. We need to understand exactly what's going on, particularly as a different economy shift. I'm talking about the growth of China and Brazil and India and some of the trading blocks that they're developing, South America, the trading block among South American countries, the United States, and make no mistake, the United States military is working on behalf of Western capital. That's what it is. It's the partnership between government, the government military complex, and capital, corporations. And so that's what we're seeing, and we need to be aware of it. And we've got to mobilize to do something about it.
How would you suggest? What kind of suggestions would you give towards folks mobilizing around it, as you say?
Well, the first thing, again, is to be aware of it. Is to become informed about it. Is to find out the facts, what's really going on. You know, and then people have to not only become informed, but then to be politicized. You know, to get involved politically, and to understand what is happening with this country, with the budget of this country, with taxpayer dollars, and to start to make some decisions about some serious issues. We've seen how on the right, how regressives have mobilized. Just last fall, the so-called teabag movement, and, you know, and the 9/12ers, and how they mobilized over these fabricated grassroots movements, these AstroTurf movements. You know, so folks on the right have been able to mobilize and have been able to influence policy. And in fact, the right has done a brilliant job of it in stages. Actually, you know, we saw the regressive trajectory of this country, starting with the Reagan administration. But there was a lurch to the right prior to that, with when Nixon was elected president, and the groundwork for for that was laid with Barry Goldwater.
Peter, we have a call real quick. We have a call from Washington D.C., and I just want to take this call because
Greetings, Ashley. I'm calling. Hi, greetings, Ashley. I'm calling from outside of Baltimore. This is Sabrina. We're talking about Haiti. We forgot something very vital here that happened during the 80s and the 90s, and that was that caused the discrimination of why Haitians were not allowed in this country. And that was because of the fear of AIDS. I remember being with the member of ACT UP, and there were two groups that were basically in fear of people being scared of contracting AIDS. That was the white gays and the Haitian community. And the reason that happened was because outside of in Florida, south of Miami, it was well known that to Haiti, that was a playground. And basically because of the impoverished conditions that were within Haiti, was that unfortunately people that were having families, the only way that they could be of having any type of money for their families was being involved in having sex. Hence why there were what was deemed to the United States the majority of people having HIV. So they were prevented from this country, coming from this country reason for that. When Clinton came in power, Clinton did not want only just for the reason of Aristide to be in place, as we saw with his campaign that first year when he campaigned in the 1990s, 1992.
Right.
There were two things that people were marching and demonstrating on. And one of the marches, which I was at with Arthur Ashe and Catherine Dunham, and this march was where Arthur Ashe, gave his life for Haiti, meaning that he was one of those people willing to be arrested, and he knew that once he was detained, arrested, that the media would be off of the focus because of him being a, quote, celebrity. So he waited until the end to be arrested. And, of course, he only had a straw hat. And being, as everyone knows, of him having AIDS, it was very dangerous for him. And this was one of the last public demonstrations that Arthur Ashe had participated. So he gave his life for Haiti. So when Clinton came into power, you know, of course, like you said, he reneged on his promise on with Aristide. Now, there were two key points of those demonstrations. One was to remove that ban of Haitians being prevented in this country. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they did, eventually did remove it. And the other thing was bringing Aristide in power. And, of course, Clinton did not want to do it, and people took to the streets again. So he was forced to put the hand out there and allow Aristide to come back in. Now, another thing key point to here is that Wycliffe's uncle, Jamal Joseph, who was a Bush appointee with the of being in place of when Aristide was kicked out,
right,
and hence he got to be ambassador. There, a key point which I demand overall for Latin America and for the Far East, and obviously in Haiti, is to demand that Jamal Joseph be removed, that the Clintons be removed in any capacity that they are,
right,
and that Rahm Emanuel be removed, as well as Bill Gates. And, of course, you mentioned the history of Bill Gates. Bill Gates of Latin America, when he was in charge of the CIA, a good friend of mine, Jennifer Harbury, did a protest against him where he was removed. And the Bush administration put him back in place, and hence we have him now, which, unfortunately, Obama left the appointees, the Bush appointees, in place, which are basically to undermine anything possible. And, of course, with us, the people around the world, of losing out because of this type of imperialism that is being put in place.
Exactly.
Right. Those are great points, Sabrina. I really appreciate that. And Sabrina, do you have any insight in terms of if people want to give, what are some reliable organizations in terms of directing their money and their resources to, rather than you know, the Red Cross and Yale Haiti and so forth?
There are thousands of them. A good comrade that we know that's of the Washington, D.C., and is also of Haiti, that lives in South Florida, Max Rameau, who's been with the Take Back the Land, meaning those that have been homeless because of foreclosures and beavers and such as that, has been mobilizing within Florida. So there's www.fanm.org, which is organized with Haitian women within Latin America. There's Lucius Walker, who reaches out to a lot of people out there. You know, you can Google him, Pastors for Peace. And there's also there are two organizations that Max told me of, MyServeThePeople.org, which is basically for donations as far as for people. I had sent out an email, and I'll send it out again. And what their strategic point at this part is, those organizations that were against the imperialism have lost a lot here. PADUP and other organizations within Haiti have lost a lot. So they look at this as a long, strong building of not only getting donations in need that are necessary now, but to also help for that political structure that is needed for fighting off the imperialism. I'll resend that email out to you because I forgot what the other organization was. And another good one is Partners in Health, who's been down there, and as well as with the Venezuelans and the Cubans, have pointed out about the imperialism are not allowing for the aid to come through as it should be, because there's lots and thousands of people that have been giving aid, but it's the U.S. militarism that is not allowing to come through.
Right, we
need to demand that be stopped, because as of yesterday morning, they were saying that with the children that were being airlifted, they were putting a stop to that. And also putting a stop to those that were being able to come over, you know, from at least to Florida and Georgia. Those governors have insisted a ban be put in place for that.
Right. And before you leave, Sabrina, can you do two things? Can you give your email address out so that people can contact you for that information and be put on your listserv? And, you know, I just recognize this is Sabrina, who is a terrific activist in the Baltimore, Washington area. And also, you know, when you give your email address out, can you give us an update on the status of Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal? Because I know that you and many others have been mobilizing around to try to get him.
Oh, yes. We are in a desperate situation. They took it the anniversary of Martin Luther King's birthday. And quite interesting, some of the points that the prejudice of Pennsylvania have done has always been on the anniversary of King, before, when they had an execution warrant against Mumia in 1995, Marcus Garvey's birthday and such like that. And that decision that the Supreme Court chose to hear it on the actual King birthday and came out with the result at the end was basically they kind of agreed with the state prosecution, meaning putting it back in Judge Yarn's hands, which is basically using up the many chances or at least opportunities that Mumia has to fight for justice. And I need to point out that the appeals to the death penalty processes were put in place by Clinton when he was in office as president. So this situation is very dangerous for Mumia. And so I would strongly suggest that people go to freemumia.com, which is the New York Coalition and International Conservative Family Friends internationally, the organization, to find out the current updates and keep in track and sign on to be alerted for any information concerning Mumia at this time. Upcoming up in May 13 will be the MOVE anniversary, which is the May 13th, the day that they bombed MOVE, destroying two neighborhoods in Philadelphia. So that will be coming up. And the MOVE 9, last year was a chance for them to be paroled, but the parole board refused that to have that day happen. So the MOVE 9 have been denied parole. So I would strongly suggest people be on alert, because there is going to be a chance that we have to be mobilized in Philadelphia, because Rendell, who is a good friend of Obama, has always been have shown his hatred toward Mahmoud and Mumia Abu-Jamal since the 70s, and now he is governor, and he's hyperactive to get his pen going to sign the execution warrant for Mumia Abu-Jamal. We have to take that very seriously. My email, that's free, F-R-E-E, the, T-H-E, move, M-O-V-E, 9, digit 9, Mumia, M-U-M-I-A, at gmail.com. That's free, the move 9, Mumia, at gmail.com.
Thank you so much for calling, and thanks for that valuable, all that valuable information you gave us, Sabrina. I look forward to seeing
Thank you, the opportunity.
All right, take care.
Yeah, that's good information. Not only good information, Salma, but also she pointed out some other layers in the situation with Haiti in terms of the AIDS crisis. And that's not simply to be understood as a medical situation, but certainly an economic situation too. There's an economic layer to the AIDS crisis in Haiti, in the United States, especially in Africa. So globally, and so that data point that she raised, it fits into the puzzle. And then talking about Mumia in terms of we talked about the militarization of society, and then to bring in the prison industrial complex into the conversation, and all of the racism that's involved in Mumia's situation. You know, these are all parts of the same puzzle. These are not just scattershot bits and pieces of information. They're all connected, it was instructive, that she raised those issues too to bring into to this conversation today.
Without a doubt, and she's been doing a lot of strong work. I've been blessed to know her for the last couple of years, and she continues is ceaseless in her work to mobilize and to organize and to work on behalf of those folks that mainstream society tries to get us to forget about. Those are brothers like Mumia and other political prisoners that are in prison right now, some sitting on death row. So,
right.
And like you said, there are a lot of intersectionalities that connect one to the next, especially when we look at,
right.
at Haiti. And
yeah.
Mumia,
so
go on.
If I could just finish my previous thought about the question you asked me in terms of organizing, and Sabrina and her activities in organizing, that's if I could just sum up in short, that's what we need to do on the left, is to organize an independent political movement, and I mean independent from the corporate parties of the Democrats and the Republicans. So, obviously we don't have the time to go into strategies for that and, just how to make that happen. But in short, that's kind of the direction that we need to move in, is to become informed, become politicized and mobilized, and organize an independent political movement.
Right, definitely. And another important thing is that we need to link up. I think that there's a lot of strong, unique organizations that are doing great work in various communities throughout the U.S. and doing those work in those communities, and a lot, oftentimes their work is permeated in countries outside the U.S. and I think it's important to link up with those folks that are doing that kind of work and joining forces, because creating coalitions is extremely, extremely important. There's a lot of information that's even on a very basic level. When you link up with other organizations, such as Sabrina, I mean, she sends out information all the time, and just the information that she sends out in the listservs is able to provide me with unique perspectives on certain things that I hadn't looked at before, and that's the beauty. That's I think as a human being, that's what you seek, is to seek a higher understanding of complex issues, so that you can equip yourself with the knowledge and know-how to defeat these things and to work towards creating a better, more equitable society, you know, for everybody. Because, you know, as we look at the U.S., it's many ways it's, you know, being a man of cloth, it's Babylon. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. So, I wanted to play this cut, this really quick cut, and on the other side, I want to, you know, get your final thoughts, and we'll adjourn for this time, and you know, this will by far not be the last time Peter joins us, you know, as co-host. But I wanted to play this cut, you know, because I am a hip hop aficionado. You know, I'm a child of the golden era of hip hop, the conscious era of hip hop, and one of the groups that I really gravitated towards growing up that put things, global issues and domestic issues, in a perspective that spoke to a young, you know, child of Africa like myself, was Poor Righteous Teachers. And one of their members, Wise Intelligent, is now a solo artist. And I just wanted to play this song on the other, and I'll allow Peter to give his final thoughts and perspectives.
Motherfuckers, American me. No, I ain't stutter, though I speak broken English, I teach. Yeah, we got issues, cracks and pistols, blood spilling the street. Black babies suffer from a diet of hate over beats. Teachers and preachers, politicians, musicians for gain. Making a killing by concealing the cause of my pain. Radio stations making mountains of money to play. Rich corporations, advertisements in front of my face. These corporations never come to my hood to get the bird's eye view of how the shit ain't good. They just position products to exploit the black dollar, and our blatant lack of knowledge of our vast spending power. Cowards never think to spend a cent in the brick, as long as niggas keep spending dough on frivolous shit. We get a million life-size Hennessy scripts. Thanks to mainstream media for selling them shit.
Easter life is gonna be alright. Easter life is gonna be alright. Honey, he's been living on this wilderness, searching to find some peace and
in a youth. What may I been do? Oh, to make you know, divide and conquer, the views pun, we yo.
Scramble for hip-hop, 1880 conference of Berlin. Scramble for Africa and all her resources again. We haven't learned from the shit that they did to us then. That's why we suffer, ignorance is the wickedest sin. We send our babies to the same institutions that slaved us for education on the world from their conqueror's view. The textbooks are damn near 30 years old that they gave us. The teachers union try to tell you I'm bonkers, it's true. Black educators, lawyers, doctors, and rappers alike, who getting money and positions of power and fame. Don't try to separate yourself from Israel and the plight by looking down on the less fortunate with disdain.
Easter life is gonna be alright. Easter life is gonna be alright. 100 years of living on this wilderness, searching to find some peace and rest.
Eurocentric supremacist system based on oppression, politics, race, and cracketalism. Shakes the people into groups and classes so the masses won't rise up against their asses. Thus, black people think that when they seek social mobilization and move from poor to middle class, they will take their salvation. Your 3 degrees and your PhDs won't change the fact to them, you a nigga. Do the knowledge, do the shit through the eyes of Caucasians, who ain't even 15% the world's population. If not for white supremacy, they face annihilation. Thus, the need to subjugate and oppress the darker nations. But all white people ain't evil, they all ain't racist. Just don't ask them for reparations.
My friends are not racist.
Bet they ask us never say shit about the Clear Channel playlist, and I fight for reparations. So,
Easter life is gonna be alright. Easter life is gonna be alright. 400 years of living on this wilderness, you searching to find some peace and rest. We press the turntable, some bright part one. Spin on them back and rock microphones. So, Easter life is gonna be alright. Easter life is gonna be alright.
That was Y is Intelligent. The name of the song was Israelite. And I want to give out, before I turn it to Peter to give his final words for this show, wanted to give out two websites that Sabrina just emailed me. That's www.myservethepeople.org. That's myservethepeople.org. Myservethepeople.org. And the other website is papda.org. That's papda.org. Those are two reliable organizations that you can, you know, feel safe in terms of giving your money to, rather than going to the Red Cross and other organizations that have a very tainted history, to say the least, in terms of you know, they basically you know, botched, didn't provide the help that the people in Katrina needed. I mean, it was you know, there's no wonder why a lot of Black folks have very strong adverse feelings about the Red Cross. They it was a bungled job on various levels, and they contributed to it by you know basically helping to evacuate people, telling people to get out. This was after the flood, and they also played their role in assuring that the disaster capitalists moved in and usurped the property of many Black New Orleans residents, you know. And so it goes on and on. But I want to, you know, I want to turn it over to Peter. You know, what are your, you know, we have about 8 minutes left, and I wanted to get your final thoughts on this program. And surely we may be in a position in a couple of weeks where we have to do another follow-up to really continue to check the status of what's going on in Haiti, to bring a heightened perspective. So, you know, what are your final thoughts?
The tune you just played, Solomon, is an excellent segue to just wrapping up some thoughts here. And as you were playing that, a couple things came to mind, and they're coded into our conversation. But just let me say that the kind of positive hip-hop of a conscious type that you just played that sample of, that's the kind of thing that is minimized by the corporate media. You know, we don't hear the kind of positive consciousness hip-hop that's out there. We don't hear that on the radio. You know, Clear Channel and the corporate media stations are not playing that. BET is not showing those videos. You know, and so there's a whole different perception of what hip-hop is in mainstream America, in as opposed to, you know, its roots as an expression of consciousness and some of the highly conscious music and lyrics that are out there. So, you know, that kind of stuff needs to be played and heard. And then the second is a corollary to that, just about consciousness. You know, and it's that same level of consciousness that the lyrics of that hip hop tune that you just played, that is evident in the conversation that we've had over the last 2 hours, the input from Sabrina on a couple different topics, the clips from Glenn Ford and the information on Black Agenda Report, the Black is Back movement. These are all streams of the same river of consciousness, but they're just in different forms. And so those are the kind of things that we need to tap into and to organize around. You know, I mentioned earlier about organizing independently, and we've got to tap into those various streams of consciousness. We've got to pull the conscious hip-hop in, so we've got to pull in the movement for liberation from the prison industrial complex into it. We've got to pull in international economics. We've got to pull in intellectuals. It's got to be a grassroots element to it. And so you know, the conversation we've had on Haiti, it's just a part of the bigger puzzle. for the liberation of human beings. And I'm not talking about just black Americans. I'm not talking about just expatriated Africans. I'm not talking about just poor people. I'm talking about the human race, about liberation of the human race. And, you know, if people don't take that seriously, then refer to the comments that we just heard and discussed about the militarization of society. You know, that there is a force that's working to keep people oppressed in this country and around the planet. And Haiti is just a case study in that. So we need to understand Haiti, but we also need to understand the bigger picture. And this is a great forum to get that process started. So again, appreciate being able to come on and have the opportunity to share some thoughts with regard to that.
Without a doubt, and you're, you know, like I said, this is also your forum, so you're welcome back on this program many, many times from now, and without a doubt, you know, from our conversations off here, I expect to have you on the show many, many times from now, you know, as a contributor to the show.
I look forward to that.
Definitely. And so, once again, his name is Peter Fowler, and if you want to email him, his email is peter.fowler@yahoo.com, and that's peter.fowler@yahoo.com. Am I right with that?
That's correct.
Okay. So please, you know, reach out, email him. He's in Arizona. You know, and this is how we make our spider web much stronger. We allow ourselves to branch out and not, you know, and not prevent ourselves by keeping ourselves contained within our own community. We have to join arms with folks in our community, and we also have to see the common struggles and the common battles that are being fought in different geographic regions, not just in the U.S., but throughout the world. So you know, we've got this thing called the World Wide Web that, without a doubt, if folks like Malcolm had and Ida B. Wells had, guaranteed they would have found a way to utilize it to more than just watching YouTube videos and things of that nature. It's a strong means of communication. So hope to see you guys next time. Please forward this link out to all of your friends. Pass it far and wide. You know, knowledge is power, information is a power, and we need to educate ourselves, you know, as we go into battle to try to eliminate imperialism, capitalism, white supremacy from this country, from the globe. This is Solomon. This is your world news, and this is Wise Intelligent taking us out with another track called Globe Holders.
In 1950, the AIDS virus was fed to nearly 300,000 black youth in Africa in the form of an oral polio vaccine by Dr. Hilary Kaprowski, who is currently the director of biovirology at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. Today, a child dies every minute of HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. In the U.S., African Americans represent 49% of all new AIDS cases. The globe holders, the population controllers, the AIDS makers, dark nation depopulators, the conscious trainers, American Nazi bankers, the tower bombers, right-wing Al-Qaeda sponsors, Hitler's accomplice, 9/11 mission accomplished, free your conscience, in ghettos they kill the prophets, the juggernauts, the alphabet cops, the CIA, TSBI, the coca crops, imported to local blocks, the 5 years for the black to the month that the cracker got, a powder pot, compared to a gram of rock, got blacks at 50% of the prison pop, the whacking huts, the correction corporations, the international plan Parenthood Federation, the forced abortion, forced sterilizations, the sons of Satan, Operation Depopulation. From 1924 to 1976, 32 states in the U.S. utilized eugenics programs to depopulate the country of so-called weak breeds who were downbreeding the American population. Some 65,000 black youth from public school districts throughout the country were given a biased IQ test. All who failed the test were sterilized against their or their parents' wills. The diamond dealers, them choppers and baby killers, the oil drillers, black nation resource stealers, the truth concealers, suppression of true guerrillas, Patrice Lumumba, Nkrumah, Lauren Kabila, the people traitors, poor population enslavers, the black slash brown slash yellow baby cremators, the black slash brown slash yellow unity haters, the red slash white slash blue liberty waivers, eugenicists, world imperialists, evolutionists, black womb pollutionists, the euthanizers, third world birth sterilizers, Nazi sympathizers, finances and arms suppliers, the nuke igniters, the world health organizers, the virus writers, smallpox, Ebola slices, the throne of surfers, the worst death deservers, the devil worship, more power for every murder. A 1996 expose by the San Jose Mercury News documented CIA involvement in a Nicaraguan drug ring which poured thousands of kilos of cocaine into Los Angeles African-American neighborhoods in the 1980s. Drug boss Danilo Blandon, now an informant for the DEA, acknowledged under oath the drugs for weapons deals with the CIA-sponsored Contras. The Club of Rome, World Bank, the Skull and Bones, Alhamdulillah engraved in the Pope's throne, the camouflage, the right versus left mirage, Bush and Kerry got naked to pledge in the same lodge, the Reagan years, the luminous presidents, ever since they've been facing the obelisk, the Kabbalist, Harry Potter is not a myth, this ain't on radio, but this that shit. The war on drugs has been a war on poor people, particularly poor urban African-American men and women. It's well documented that police enforcement of the new harsh drug laws have been focused on low-level dealers in communities of color. Arrests of African-Americans have been about 5 times higher than arrests of whites, although whites and African-Americans use drugs at about the same rate. African-Americans have been imprisoned in numbers even more disproportionate than their relative arrest rates. It is estimated that in 1994, on any given day, one out of every 128 U.S. adults was incarcerated, while one out of every 17 African-American adult males was incarcerated. The differential in sentencing for powder and crack cocaine is one glaring example of institutionalized racism. About 90% of crack arrests are of African-Americans, while 75% of powder cocaine arrests are of whites. Under federal law, it takes only 5 grams of crack cocaine to trigger a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence, but it takes 500 grams of powder cocaine, 100 times as much, to trigger the same sentence for a white boy.